From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. At the end of January, the Food and Drug Administration proposed changes to its guidelines for blood donations, specifically for gay and bisexual men. Actually, the phrase public health experts use is men who have sex with men, or MSM, and we can get into those nuances in a bit. But the short version is that, rather than the current rule, which requires all MSMs and their partners to abstain from sexual contact for 3 months before being allowed to donate, the proposal would end that deferral and shift instead to individual risk assessments for all potential donors. This is not the first policy shift on MSMs. Back in 1985, amid concerns about HIV transmission, there was a lifetime ban on blood donations. That was in place for 30 years when it changed to a one-year deferral period, basically requiring 12 months of abstinence before donation. Then in April 2020, we got the three-month waiting period, which again is where it stands now. The FDA has long faced criticism over these guidelines, and while some are applauding the proposal, others say it doesn't go far enough. To talk about what's in the proposed guidelines and the science behind them, we're joined now by Dr. Catherine Barr. She's an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine and an attending physician in infectious diseases at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Dr. Barr, welcome to the 21st Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by Jerry Cardin. He was the first chair of the Gay Community AIDS Project in Champaign. Jerry, welcome back to the program to you.
Good to be here again. Thank you.
And finally, we're joined by Amanda Hess, Vice President for Donor Relations and Marketing at Impact Life, a Midwestern blood bank with donation centers in Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, and Wisconsin. Amanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, what do you think about the FDA's proposed changes? Do you have concerns about the guidelines? Join our conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455, or send an email to talk@21stshow.org. All right, Dr. Barr, I want to begin with you. Can you say more about what exactly is in the FDA's proposal?
Yes, so the FDA is charged with protecting the blood supply so that we can be confident that it is as safe as possible to provide blood and blood products to patients or to people who need blood for any reason. And they've been pushed for a long time to be more equitable and more science-based in their eligibility requirements. And they've proposed these new standards, which essentially would get rid of assigning risk based on a gender or a sexual identity, and instead look at individual risk assessments. So asking people what are the behaviors that they've practiced in the recent time, the past 3 months, that may increase their risk for recent HIV acquisition, and therefore have an individualized assessment of if there's an increased risk of HIV in those blood products that they're donating. That's one of the major changes, and I think that's the one we should or we can focus on. But I will mention there's also some changes in regards to people who are taking antiretroviral therapy as a preventive strategy to prevent new acquisition of HIV. And those guidelines have also shifted.
Well, yeah, let's come back to that. And I guess maybe I should mention if anyone is listening out there with young children, obviously this is an adult conversation that's going to include some discussion of things that adults do. So that being said, Dr. Barr, what are some of the things that could cause a potential donor to be deferred with this risk assessment survey?
Right. So basically, there's many different screening questions, but in terms of sexual acquisition of HIV, the risk factors would be, have you had a new partner? Have you had multiple partners in the past 3 months? And that would raise the possibility that you could have been recently exposed to HIV, and therefore they would want to screen blood or defer a donation at that time. I should say that one of the reasons why recent activity is so important is because in HIV diagnostics, our tests are really accurate for people who live with HIV for a longer period of time. But in recent infection, it's more challenging to diagnose HIV, and therefore the FDA and blood donation screening is very concerned about recent infection. And that's why the past 3 months of behaviors are particularly focused on.
Jerry, I want to bring you into the conversation now. What was your initial reaction when you heard about this change?
Well, I am pleased that they are finally beginning to open up what we felt were very unfair regulations from the standpoint of behavior, from the standpoint of anybody can contract HIV, not just men who have sex with men. And I believe the major gay organizations, including GLAAD, are trying to debunk some of the stereotypes and some of the past history from the standpoint of it should just be based on that there shouldn't be any specifications that are different for men who have sex with men as opposed to any other identity. Because anybody could be having sex with somebody that's infected with HIV.
Yeah, and Amanda, let me bring you into the conversation now. Amanda Hess with Impact Life. Obviously, the word impact is right in the name of your organization. A lot of blood banks and hospitals say they've been operating with a shortage of blood supplies. So what kind of impact are you hoping that this might have on blood donations?
Well, anytime the FDA opens the eligibility and expands the pool of donors able to give, that can be a good thing in terms of supporting the blood supply. My short answer in terms of what this change will do is that we just don't know. This is a good change. It is based on the latest data and science, and it's been something that blood centers have been advocating throughout the country for some time for this change. But the new deferral that's being proposed, it will the good part is that it's going to be asked of every donor, whether they have had new or multiple sexual partners in the last 3 months. And then a follow-up question will ask whether or not they have had anal sex in the last 3 months. And that is what will be a determining factor for the deferral. So the reality is, we don't know who will become eligible or who will maybe no longer be eligible. And so I hesitate to say that this is a solution to address a shortage when we don't know how many additional donors it will bring in, but we think it's a good thing and we're very glad to see it happen. Right now, 60% of the population is eligible to give and only 5% do.
Wow, 60% and 5%. Interesting. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. You can join our conversation at 800-222-9455 if you have a perspective on what we've been talking about, which is a proposed change from the Federal Food and Drug Administration, basically ending what had been a blanket ban and then a 1 year waiting period and then a 3 month waiting period for donating blood among gay and bisexual men, or more specifically, men who have sex with men. And instead, there's going to be an individualized risk assessment. That is assuming these rules, which are, again, still in the proposal phase, there's public comment, assuming that they are eventually adopted. And we can talk a little later about the timeline for that. We're talking about all this with Amanda Hess, who is with Impact Life, blood bank here in the Midwest. Jerry Carden, who is involved with a number of LGBTQ organizations and was the first chair of the Gay Community AIDS Project in Champaign, and Dr. Catherine Barr, who is a doctor specializing in infectious diseases at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. Again, 800-222-9455 is the number to call in. Dr. Barr, is this about a breakthrough in the science? What's the evidence behind this change? Talk more about that.
Personally, I think the science to support this sort of individual risk assessment has been around for quite a while, and many groups from both science and community organizations and blood donors have been pushing for this change from in the United States. Other countries have actually implemented this type of individual risk assessment for blood donation years ago. So we actually have, in addition to science supporting our ability to very accurately screen blood products, we have experience from many other countries like the United Kingdom and Canada and many other European and just many countries around the world who've had these sorts of changes and have witnessed very safe blood donation practices that follow. So there's both experiential as well as good science to support that these are very safe. I'll also just mention that there's a lot of science supporting the fact that when we have stigmatizing or discriminatory practices, the people we exclude from these practices, they do suffer harm. So it does cause mental health issues when we tell people that you are not eligible for a blood donation for an unfound reason. And we know that it makes access to healthcare more and more challenging because people from the LGBTQ community often experience discriminatory activities when they're engaging with healthcare. This is just one more layer or one more barrier to them accessing really good healthcare. So I think that from many levels, the data really support this sort of change.
Was there ever evidence for this sort of policy, or was this more about gay panic, as I think it's been called,
well,
back in the 80s?
Certainly in 1985, when the initial lifetime ban was produced, there was very little understanding of exactly how HIV was transmitted, very little scientific ability to accurately diagnose and screen individuals as well as blood products. And so we really did population-based exclusion. So we said, this group of people seems to have more HIV, so we're going to exclude them. This group of people, that group of people. Well, we've really evolved from there. The science is excellent in terms of screening blood products and diagnosing individuals. And we have a much better sense of how HIV is transmitted and what is this, you know, what is the level of virus? What is the way to detect any virus that could be transmitted? So it was probably in the 80s very reasonable to do whatever we could to prevent transmission via blood products. But we have, in the past 30 years, evolved substantially on all those fronts.
Let's go to the phones. Jonathan is calling from Peoria on line 4. Jonathan, thank you for calling in.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a statement. I am currently in a monogamous relationship with another man at the moment, and because of the policy, I made a choice to donate anyway because I'm a universal donor. And I think just because of how much the LGBTQ community donated post-AIDS blood, I think knowing what we know now, I am very glad that they are finally taking this down so people who do want to donate can do it in an open and honest way. And that's
interesting. So you had to sort of, like, I don't know, what would you say, not be fully forthcoming with the people when you were donating?
Basically, I knew I had donated before without the question, and I made the decision when I started donating to organizations like the American Red Cross that I know what I should do, but I also know what that I have the capability of donating, and I know that what I'm going to be doing is safe. So, yes, I did make that decision. So,
all right. Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you sharing your perspective with us today on the show. Thanks for calling in. And Jerry, take me back to the 80s when the first iteration of these restrictions went into place. I understand that there were tough decisions that had to be made, right? You have a blood drive at the workplace.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, talk about that.
And as Dr. Barr was stating, I think most gay men really understood at that time frame that the largest number of cases were showing up in gay men or men who had sex with men. And there was an early change from gay men being restricted as to men who have sex with men, because I know a number of men who are married, say, in an opposite sex relationship, who don't consider themselves gay because they are in an opposite sex relationship, but they're still out having sex with other men. And so I think early on, I think most of the people in the gay community were understanding of that. But as Dr. Barr was stating, that the science has changed. We know so much more. And there's so many organizations that are saying that this should be the same questions for everybody, whether you're somebody who's having sex with men or not. And I think the American Medical Association, the American Red Cross, the American Public Health Association are all stating that the changes are necessary and that they've been too slow in coming. And I'll just state, based on the caller a little bit ago, I believe Jonathan from Peoria, I'm in a monogamous relationship. We've been together for 42 years. Prior to the ban, which I understood at the time, I was a gallon donor. I worked in healthcare and I was always at every blood drive and then, you know, stopped. And now I'm kind of at the point where, you know what, you don't want blood, so be it.
Yeah. I mean, I gather, and we've got to take a break in about a minute, but I mean, it must have been tense, right? Because this is not a time when everybody was certainly out about their sexual orientation. And you know, if there's a work blood drive, then that's maybe a tough choice for people.
Well, I would just take issue with that. Not everybody was out about their
sexual
orientation.
Right, that's what I meant to say, if I phrased it badly.
Yeah. And so I know people that, because of a work blood drive and the pressure to give at a work blood drive, they really weren't eligible because they were having sex with other men, but they would still go ahead because it would raise eyebrows if, oh, well, Joe, why aren't you donating this time? And you could always make up a story. Well, my platelets were low or this or that or the other thing. But I think they got to the point where you could go ahead and donate and then tell. I remember hearing this story somewhere along the line in that trajectory. But you could go ahead and give so it wouldn't raise eyebrows. But then you could just tell the person that was working that, no, you shouldn't use that blood.
Don't use that blood. Okay.
I don't know if that was the case that either Dr. Barr or Amanda Hess remember.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. We're speaking about a new FDA proposal that would end the deferral on men who have sex with men donating blood and instead go to an individualized risk assessment. We'll talk a little bit more about this when we return. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Barr, Jerry Carden, and Amanda Hess. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the FDA's move to make blood donation easier for men who have sex with men and their partners. We're speaking with Dr. Catherine Barr of the University of Pennsylvania's School of Medicine, Jerry Carden, who helped found the Greater Community AIDS Project in Champaign, and Amanda Hess from Impact Life, which is a Midwestern blood bank. Dr. Barr, I wanted to ask you more about the testing. Isn't all blood donated tested for HIV anyway? And I think it's also tested for hepatitis B, yet now we're going to have a screening tool for HIV, not for hepatitis B necessarily. Talk about why this is, you know, why this screening assessment is necessary.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. So all blood products are screened for multiple infectious pathogens. So this includes viruses like hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, as well as other types of bacteria. You know, bacteria that can cause other diseases are also screened for. And we have good faith in the screening capacity of these tests. And that's why we sort of strongly endorse the safety of our blood products when we need to give them to patients, et cetera. I think there is perhaps a different threshold for safety that's placed with HIV transmission versus other infections. And I think we can question why that is, because we don't do the same amount of behavioral screening and sort of assessments for all other infections. Now, we do ask for certain things, like we ask if you've been to places where Jakob Creutzfeldt or mad cow disease was prevalent and you were at risk factor for that. So there are other infections that we do have behavioral screening for, but HIV does have sort of a historical precedent, and we continue with those you know, questions in addition to the layer of safety from lab testing.
And I also, Doctor, I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned this briefly earlier, but people taking medication for HIV, right? There's a lot of PrEP out there in the world. This is pre-exposure prophylaxis. That's what that stands for. But talk more about that aspect of these proposed guidelines.
Yeah, so pre-exposure prophylaxis is a type of HIV medicine that can be taken preventively. So it can prevent acquiring HIV if you think there may be exposures in your future. This is a wonderful medicine that's incredibly effective when taken, and we strongly encourage people who have any risk factors for acquiring HIV to, you know, speak to their providers about taking this. But because the antiretrovirals are in people's blood, it, for the most part, is incredibly effective. But if there's a breakthrough infection, it makes diagnosis much more challenging. And we're still kind of learning as a field exactly how to do diagnosing individuals' recent infection when they're on PrEP. And therefore, I think it's reasonable for the FDA to pause as we continue to evaluate more and more evidence on how to best diagnose people with breakthrough infections on PrEP. we can pause that donor eligibility as we continue to learn from the science.
Amanda, just a few minutes left in our conversation. I've emphasized these are still just proposals at this point. Assuming that they are adopted, how soon do you think Impact Life would be able to implement them?
Right. So the comment period is 60 days from the 27th when the draft guidance was issued. So a relatively quick period, but there will be a period after it's finalized of about 6 to 12 months that blood centers across the country will need to update their software programs, to update their standard operating procedures. And the donor history questionnaire that we use actually also has to be updated and approved by the FDA, which is another step before we can start accepting additional donors. So we will be working diligently to modify these changes. Some blood centers may be able to start accepting donors in 4 or 5 months. Others may need 9 months. So it's just really important for the community to understand kind of those timelines and work with your local blood bank if you have any questions on eligibility and when changes are occurring and how you're able to come in. We encourage that anyways for folks to call us if they have eligibility questions before they come in. Sometimes people just like to talk through that before coming in to donate. We have also, in addition to excellent testing processes, we have additional processes to address some of the privacy concerns that Jerry was talking about earlier. Now, individuals that give with Impact Life, for example, they can take the donor history questionnaire electronically from the comfort of their own home. And technological advances like this, I think, will continue to help in terms of keeping donor privacy and confidentiality intact.
Jerry, I want to give you the last question. What else do you think can be done to mitigate the lasting stigma that has come from this policy?
Well, I don't know that we're going to ever mitigate the stigma against the LGBTQ plus community in general. And some of that stigma seems to be growing, as we know, in these last few months, years, et cetera. But I do believe that many of these changes are long overdue, and I applaud the people that have been involved in making the changes. Maybe once again, I'll be able to donate.
Do you think you will? You mentioned you were a gallon donor and then sort of, you know what, my blood, fine. Do you think you'll go back?
No, I'm not one to carry a long-term grudge. I know that the blood products are needed. And there have been times that, you know, somebody had an injury or surgery and the local blood center was in short supply. And I almost went in and, you know, lied my way through the questionnaire, but I didn't want to do that. And so I don't know. It's a balance. There is some animosity, I think, toward the history, but yet time marches on. And even though it's long overdue, we're, you know, hopefully getting to those changes that are needed.
Jerry Carden helped found the Greater Community AIDS Project in Champaign. Amanda Hess is with Impact Life, Midwestern Blood Bank, and Dr. Catherine Barr of the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.